Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Most of us know what it means to run out of money. Even if we haven't experienced it, we know what it means. Same with companies that find themselves with zeros on the balance sheet. But what exactly happens when the world's eighth largest economy finds itself out of cash and with no plan? California, here you come, right back where you started from. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done, online at elance.com. And by the First 5 Years Fund, working to expand early learning for the nation's most at-risk children and provide benefits for society, ffyf.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the 30th and final day of June. Here in California, we endure endless jokes and sight gags about our state cracking off and falling into the Pacific. Well, money-wise, it could happen if our politicians can't find a solution to a budget impasse before the clock strikes midnight. The state is facing a $24 billion shortfall. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says he will not agree to the most recent package of tax increases and spending cuts proposed by Democratic lawmakers. Without some sort of legislation, California's piggy bank will empty. Joining us now from the state capitol in Sacramento is reporter Evan Halper of the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us.
Thanks for having me, Tess.
Just remind us very briefly, how on earth did we get to this point?
Well, tax revenues have dropped off precipitously, and California is a state that is overly reliant on income taxes. As soon as things drop off, as they have over the last several months, the state certainly winds up in a budget crisis, as it continually has over the last many years.
Well, the talk now is that if there is not a solution, that by Thursday, we could be looking at IOUs going out to everyone that the state normally pays. What will those actually look like? Is that going to be a piece of paper that people get in the mail?
Yeah. I mean, if you're used to getting a check from the state, instead you'll get this kind of registered warrant, this IOU. There will be a panel that will decide what interest rate the state will pay on these IOUs, and the banks will probably make their decision on whether it's worth their while to honor the IOUs based on what interest they can get out of them.
So it sounds like there's still a little confusion over these IOUs, but is there anything that says, for example, who would get paid back first if those are issued?
There are some payments that we have to make that can't be IOUs as long as there's money in the state treasury, like payments to schools or legally guaranteed payments to repay debt. As far as paying back the IOUs that the state does send out, I believe the controller has some discretion on who gets paid back first once there's money.
So there is still money then?
There's money to do some things. There's just not enough money to do everything that state government normally does. And some of those are pretty big things. There's not going to be money, for example, to pay these welfare cash grants to the elderly, blind, and disabled. There's not going to be enough money to make payments to students receiving some financial aid. There's not enough money to make payments to many local governments.
So what does that look like? Do we have any notion of what a bankrupt state looks like? Who might feel that the most?
You know, the experts will tell you the state can't go bankrupt legally, but in sort of practice, that's kind of where we're heading.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been there in 1992 and before that, back in the Great Depression. And, you know, what it looks like is the mess. I mean, you know, if you're a vendor trying to do business with the state and you're just getting these IOUs, you're not getting paid. And then people wind up having to lay off staff. I mean, we talked to people when this almost happened last time around who, for example, have contracts with the state to bring low-income dialysis patients to their appointments. And they were having to shut down their businesses because they were going check to check and they couldn't pay their employees.
Do you think that average Californians really have any notion of how bad this is and could get? I mean, you look at, for example, the local television news. I think it was maybe the fourth or fifth story last night.
I think the Californians have been told the sky is falling so many times since, right before the recall, that they've grown numb to it, and it just looks to them like sort of more yelling in Sacramento, and the sky has not fallen yet, so they tune it out.
All right. Well, I guess we'll see what happens after midnight tonight. Evan Halper is the Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Thanks so much and good luck tonight.
Okay. Thank you, Tess.
Our government may shut down, but hey, that just puts California on the leading edge of yet another trend. Arizona, Indiana, Pennsylvania, and Mississippi are among the other states working frantically to keep the lights on. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler considers some of the common denominators.
Some of the challenges are procedural. Just as California requires a two-thirds majority to pass a budget, Arizona requires a supermajority to enact a tax increase.
It's hard enough to get a majority of legislators to agree on anything, much less a supermajority.
That's Nick Johnson, director of the State Fiscal Project at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He says some sticking points are political.
There are people in all of these states who are rigidly opposed to doing anything on the revenue side.
Which is to say, no new taxes. And then there are fiscal commitments that can't be shed, just as the federal government takes a hands-off approach to entitlements like Social Security and Medicare.
States are now seeing the same lack of flexibility with Medicaid and some other areas such as health care for public employees.
Robert Ward is deputy director of the Nelson A. Rockefeller Institute of Government, a think tank. He says one in four state tax dollars is dedicated to health care for public workers and the poor.
It has become, for many states, the biggest budgetary headache over the last 10 to 20 years.
And rising health care costs aren't expected to go away. So look forward to more budget standoffs in the years to come. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We got some details today about that new Consumer Financial Protection Agency being proposed by the Obama administration. This would be the financial equivalent of the folks who are supposed to keep us safe from lead toys and faulty appliances. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports the new agency would have powerful tools to discipline banks and other lenders.
The proposed Consumer Financial Protection Agency could issue subpoenas, hold hearings, and go after court orders to stop abusive banking practices. Assistant Treasury Secretary Michael Barr says the agency will be able to vigorously enforce consumer protections.
Our view has been you need to have regulation that establishes a level playing field for good competition, good innovation, financial innovation, on the basis of a baseline of respect and dignity that I think all consumers are owed.
Bankers, though, say the new regulator will end up hurting innovation. Scott Talbot with the Financial Services Roundtable says regulatory scrutiny will have a chilling effect on cheaper loans and credit terms.
So what you'll see is that companies will probably only offer plain vanilla products and will be reluctant to venture out into new territory and create new products for fear of overregulation or even a lawsuit for offering different types of products beyond the plain vanilla ones.
You know, I see it exactly the other way.
Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren chairs Congress's Oversight Panel on Financial Regulations.
This is about getting rid of the tricks and the traps. If the only way you can really put your product out there is to fool people, to give them a bunch of incomprehensible language, you know, bury everything in the fine print, then it's not going to work.
The president's proposal was welcomed by Democratic leaders in Congress today. They say establishing the new Consumer Protection Agency is a high priority this year. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, stocks slid today but ended the quarter with gains. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Generation Y is aged 15 through 32. Baby boomers are aged 47 to 62. You'd think they wouldn't have too much in common, but economist Sylvia Ann Hewlett has studied these generations and writes about both in the current issue of the Harvard Business Review. She says not only are the Ys and the boomers similar in their goals, working styles, likes and dislikes, they even like each other, and that's something their employers should pay attention to.
They do. I mean, obviously, they're related. The Ys are the children of the boomers. But one thing they share is this idea that a career is a fluid journey, you know, suffused with meaning and purpose and with at least some short timeouts. Another thing that's very shared is the need for much more control as to when, where, and how work is done. Flex, remote working possibilities, very powerful for these generations.
But I'd really like to hear the argument that Gen X is not interested in those things. I mean, the Gen X is right now in the moment of their lives where they're supporting children. At some point, doesn't salary become a little more important when you're supporting a family?
Well, absolutely. When we look at these three generations, and there mostly are three generations in the workplace these days, it's not that X doesn't like this stuff too, but they just can't prioritize it right now. The Ys, because they're delaying childbearing, feel that they have time for some, you know, stretch roles, some maybe short-term global assignments before they settle down. And obviously for boomers, they're into the other side of their careers.
Given these insights that you've put forth here for Gen Y and for boomers, how can companies take advantage?
I think companies, and we really show this in our research because, you know, we've been working with a lot of employers, see huge opportunity here. In a year where they can't pony up bonuses or big pay increases, it's pretty fabulous to know that they can really transform rates of engagement and, you know, their employer brand by offering a little bit more flex or an unpaid mini sabbatical.
So it's not all about money then?
It's not.
I guess I just find it really hard to imagine that in a time of 10% unemployment, that workers are going to feel like they can even ask for flex time or for a sabbatical when there are people lined up waiting to take the traditional job.
Well, I have a brilliant example for you. This last winter, KPMG, they needed to reduce their payroll costs by 15% in the UK. But instead of just, you know, firing a bunch of folks, what they decided to do was give their professionals the following choices. They could either take a four-day work week and a 20% cut in pay, mm-hmm. or they could take a mini sabbatical and, again, a 20% cut in pay, or they could choose to stay as they were. Well, as it turned out, a whole lot of people chose those earlier options. And so the company was able to do three things. There was a three-way win. First off, they did save 15% of their payroll. They had a tremendously kind of motivated professional working group who felt that they had been allowed to make important choices, and it became a whole recruiting tool. There's all kinds of ways of motivating people and make sure that they are, you know, contributing 110% of their energy at a time which is, you know, fairly rough out there.
Sylvia Hewlett is an economist and founding president of the Center for Work-Life Policy. Her article, How Gen Y and Boomers Will Reshape Your Agenda, appears in the July issue of the Harvard Business Review. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Lots of folks of all generations are taking second jobs to get through the recession, but it's hard to imagine a U.S. senator or congressman moonlighting for another paycheck. Across the pond, it is another story. Many British lawmakers hold down one, two, or even three jobs alongside their full-time gig as a member of parliament. Starting tomorrow, they will have to declare those extracurricular activities in much more detail. As Marketplace's Stephen Beard tells us, British voters are unlikely to be pleased, especially since this all follows another scandal about expense claims for things like moats.
The Gothic House of Commons has turned into a house of horrors for many of its members. First, they suffered excruciating revelations about their expense claims. Now there's more pain in store. The searchlight of public scrutiny will stab through the murk surrounding MPs' second jobs. Ken Ritchie of the Electoral Reform Society says this won't be a pretty sight.
Some of them are earning huge amounts, much more than they're earning as a member of parliament. In some cases, the second job appears to be that of being a member of parliament.
Some MPs are thought to earn an extra $400,000 a year. That's four times the parliamentary salary. MPs already have to register these outside jobs, but from tomorrow they'll have to reveal exactly how lucrative the jobs are and how much time they take up.
Politicians should have one job, and one job only. That's the job they're paid to do, And if they're doing the job properly, then that's more than a full-time job.
Labour MP John Mann says tomorrow's disclosures will demonstrate how some members are shortchanging their constituents.
If they want to do other jobs, go do other jobs, but don't be an MP as well.
Some MPs work as lawyers and doctors. There's at least one working dentist. And believe it or not, there's a man who runs a cemetery. Most of the outside jobs are consultancies and directorships. John Mann says some of this comes pretty close to corruption.
This is cash for access. It's bribing politicians in order that politicians are working on behalf of vested interests.
Order, 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 order.
Many MPs defend the practice of holding an outside job. In a recent debate, Conservative member Charles Walker said it was only fair. MPs are elected for a maximum of 5 years. They should be able to prepare for the possibility of being turfed out of Parliament.
It is very important that we allow people in this place to retain a foothold in their profession or the private sector, so when they leave this place, they are employable and can have a future.
And other members argue that Parliament itself benefits from the moonlighters' expertise. Conservative Nick Herbert.
I think many people would say that the kinds of experience brought to the table by people who are directors of companies or have financial experience and so on is actually valuable in Parliament. And it's for each individual to decide the extent to which they can balance their time.
Not anymore. From tomorrow, says Ken Ritchie of the Electoral Reform Society, it will be for the voters to decide on whose behalf their MP is really working.
The glare of publicity that is being brought on members who appear to be off at Westminster feathering their own nests, I think that is certainly going to change things.
It already has. Tomorrow's deadline for disclosure has unleashed another wave of fear in the House of Commons. MPs have been shedding directorships like dandruff. Being an MP is becoming less lucrative by the hour. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, how clicking with your mouse can pay.
Most people sit and play around on their computer or play different games all day long, and they get nothing for it. At least this, you get a little bit in return.
But first, let's do the numbers. Falling consumer confidence numbers took the wind out of Wall Street's sails today. The Dow dropped just shy of 1%, 82 points, to close at 8,447. The Nasdaq fell 0.5%, 9 points, to finish at 1,835. The S&P 500 lost 0.75%, 7 points, landing at 919. But it ended the quarter up more than 15%. News of rising foreclosures and falling home prices took the wrecking ball to home builders. KB Homes crumbled 3%, D.R. Horton subsided 1.8%, and Pulte Homes stepped down 1.5%. Lennar Corporation fell 0.2%. Bonds fell. The yield on 10-year T-notes rose to 3.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence. Online at saveandinvest.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for May. Driving right along, in Detroit, automakers release sales figures for June. And a tip for foodies, eating out gets a little cheaper. In France, sales tax on restaurants and cafes drops to 5.5% from 19.6%. Bon appetit. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Time to hear what you all think about the job we're doing and the stories we're producing. First up is an interview that Kai did with Eric Anderson, a marketing professor from Northwestern University. The topic was brand loyalty and how companies can maintain their customer base during a recession. Professor Anderson said one way to engage consumers is to mix important messages and themes, he called them, into advertising. Themes like the environment and family. But Michael Riesch of Glendale Heights, Illinois, thinks marketing is beside the point and not the way to win his loyalty or his wallet.
I remain convinced that many of our societal problems today are the result of too many marketing majors. Themes? We don't need themes. Here's a solution. Shift away from advertising and just reduce brand name prices.
Whatever the price, country singer Wynonna only pays for stuff in cash. That's what she told our reporter Sean Cole. Her comments were part of our story last week that looked at life without credit. It's the kind of life that Jim Laurie of Raleigh, North Carolina, also likes to lead.
We are with Wynonna on this. Carrying cash even affects your choice of restaurant. If you have $200 on you, you won't go to a $150 for two restaurant. And if you really want it that badly, it's worth the trip to the cash machine.
One story that generated heat and smoke was our feature on the proliferation of pot clubs here in Los Angeles. Strictly for medicinal purposes, of course, but many of you expressed outrage at the very idea. Our piece on government-subsidized hurricane reinsurance in Florida also generated ill winds. Most who wrote in think it's a bad idea. But the story that got your dander up more than any other was, surprise, surprise, last week's item about Citigroup's plans to boost some employees' salaries by half while still holding on to government bailout funds. Here's listener Steve Herndon from Katy's, Kentucky.
It should do more than raise eyebrows. It should prompt the federal government to ask for the money back and let them fail. This behavior is inexcusable.
If you think our behavior is inexcusable or perfectly all right, drop us a line. We're at marketplace.org. Just click on the link that says contact. We'll get the monthly unemployment figures on Thursday. The Labor Department is expected to announce that the economy shed more hundreds of thousands of jobs in June. Many of the newly unemployed are using their computers to make a few bucks. Some are turning to a service by Amazon.com called Mechanical Turk. The website is billed as an online marketplace where employers and workers can find each other. It's a pretty good deal for companies, but as Joel Rose discovered, it can be a tough way to make a living.
I wanted to find out if these workers are using Mechanical Turk as a substitute for a traditional job. So I did what any employer would do to find workers on the site. I wrote a description of the job, and I offered money. It wasn't very much, just 5 cents for anyone who completed a short survey. By the next morning, I had 100 replies. More than a dozen people said, yes, they're trying to replace income from a lost job.
If you're going to be on the internet anyway, you might as well find someone to pay you for it.
Doug Klor is one of those people. He lives in St. Joseph, Michigan. Klor heard about Mechanical Turk from his son at college. When Klor lost his job at Whirlpool this year, he decided to give Turking a try.
If you devoted the right amount of time to it and knew and figured out a plan, you could probably make a little money at this. And so that's when I tried to run with it just a little bit.
At last count, more than 200,000 people had registered to work on the site. Employers post hundreds of tasks a day. Surveys, proofreading, and transcription are some of the most popular. Essentially, employers are outsourcing work to a crowd. The theory is that by giving the exact same task to lots of different people, the employer can be reasonably sure it's getting done right.
This is really a new paradigm for, you know, how work gets done, and I think that is definitely something that we'll see more and more of.
That's Amazon VP Sharon Chiarella. She says the online retailer originally developed Mechanical Turk as an in-house tool to vet the data in its own catalog for consistency because computers alone couldn't do it.
We had algorithms certainly to do part of that, but we really couldn't get it 100% clean without some human being looking at some of the data and some of the information and making some judgment calls.
Amazon figured other companies might be in the same spot, so it opened Mechanical Turk to the public in 2005 and started charging employers a 10% commission. The service gets its name from an 18th century chess-playing machine that actually had a person inside moving the chess pieces. Amazon is more transparent about the people behind its Mechanical Turk. Tamara Wilhite is a technical writer and science fiction novelist near Dallas, Texas. She started Turking after her husband lost his job last fall.
It is very useful as a supplemental income. That's something that I do after I've put my own children to bed, who are 3 and 6 years old. I would not use this as a replacement to a job.
Wilhite says she works about 20 hours a month and makes up to $125. All of the Turkers I spoke to agreed that it would be really difficult to support yourself this way. There are no benefits. For some low-skill tasks, the compensation works out to less than minimum wage. On the other hand, Amazon VP Sharon Chiarella says the hours are extremely flexible, and some jobs do pay upwards of $10 an hour.
The workers who have worked longer for us have definitely become efficient and tend to work for specific types of work where they can make more money.
Mark King of Manchester, New York, just started Turking a few weeks ago. He's putting in about 10 hours a week while he looks for a full-time job in construction. King says the wages may be low, but they're better than nothing.
Most people sit and play around on their computer, play different games all day long, and they get nothing for it. At least this, you get a little bit in return.
King is hoping to put away enough money to buy Christmas presents for his wife and kids. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note for those of you still deciding on Saturday's grilling menu, how about a succulent Maine lobster at around $5 a pound? Prices are so low this season that the AP reports lobstermen and women are cutting out the middlemen and women, and selling their catch directly to consumers. If you're down east, you can just stop by and pick them up from the back of their pickup trucks, or some are even taking orders through Craigslist. Retailers, of course, are none too happy, but the catchers say it is the only way they can claw out a profit with prices at 20-year lows. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 82 points, just under 1%. The Nasdaq lost 9 points, half a percent. And the S&P 500 dropped 7 points, 0.75%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod B. Next time on the program, servicing loans and fielding fury at Bank of America.
What I've noticed is that the ones that are so appreciative at the end of the calls, that are overly, you know, really thanking me, are the ones that were many times really upset with me when they first called in.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.